Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV showed video of aid trucks moving inside the Gaza Strip after entering the Hamas-controlled territory from Egypt.
An initial aid convoy of 20 trucks entered the Gaza Strip from Egypt.
Dropping all the charges against the former Vice President, Dr. Kassim Kirumba, follows the case that the former President, Dr. Bakiri Muluzi, was also accused of some corruption cases.
Human rights defenders welcome a court decision to drop treason charges against former Malawian Vice President Kassim Kirumba.
We have a problem of, underage drinking in the country, and we're hoping that through the interaction with the global community, we will be able to come up with interventions and policies that cap the underage drinking.
And South Africa will this week host the 7th Global Alcohol Policy Conference in Cape Town. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. An initial aid convoy of 20 trucks entered the Gaza Strip from Egypt Saturday as Arab and world leaders meet in Cairo to discuss how to implement a ceasefire in the 14-day-old conflict between Israel and Hamas. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the conference he was dismayed by the inability to deliver aid supplies in sufficient quantities to those who need it. Those trucks need to move as quickly as possible in a massive, sustained and safe way from Egypt into Gaza, he said. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV showed video of aid trucks moving inside the Gaza Strip after entering the Hamas-controlled territory from Egypt. Egyptian Red Crescent officials underscored the aid was being taken to UN aid facilities inside Gaza. Israel has expressed concern that the aid intended for civilians could be confiscated by Hamas. Attending a peace conference hosted by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who visited Egypt's Rafah border crossing with Gaza Friday, emphasized his frustration over the inability to get sufficient quantities of aid to civilians who need it.
We meet in the heart of a region that is reeling in pain and one step from the precipice. A region where it is impossible not to be rocked to the core by heart-wrenching, soul-searing images of suffering. Yesterday, I went to the Rafah border crossing. There I saw a paradox. A humanitarian catastrophe playing out in real time. On the one hand, I saw hundreds of trucks teeming with food and other essential supplies. Full trucks on one side, empty stomachs on the other.
A UN aid official estimated that Saturday's 20-truck convoy into the Gaza Strip represents only 3% of the needs of its estimated 2.2 million residents. Marwan Jilani, a Palestinian Red Crescent official, told Qatar's Al Jazeera TV that aid supplies were being taken to UN facilities at Deir al-Bala, near the center of Gaza, for distribution. A Palestinian journalist sympathetic to Hamas told the TV network the convoy contained no fuel, while noting Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital, the largest in the strip, needs it urgently to run its generators. Al-Shifa is controlled by Hamas. Meanwhile, at the Cairo conference Saturday, Jordan's King Abdullah blasted Israel for its treatment of Palestinian civilians and excoriated world leaders for what he claimed was their indifference to Palestinian suffering and double standards regarding international humanitarian law.
I am outraged and grieved by those acts of violence waged against innocent civilians in Gaza, in the West Bank, and Israel. The relentless bombing campaign underway in Gaza, as we speak, is cruel and unconscionable on every level. It is collective punishment of a besieged and helpless people. It is a flagrant violation of international humanitarian law.
Several European leaders, including Spain's Pedro Sanchez, pointed out that Israel has the right to defend itself against attacks, noting the war began 2 weeks ago after Hamas launched the surprise attack on Israeli settlements, killing Israeli civilians, including women and children, and kidnapping others.
We strongly condemn the terrorist attacks perpetrated against Israel, and we also recognize Israel's right to defend itself in strict compliance with international law and international humanitarian law.
Egyptian President Sisi called the conflict in Gaza an unprecedented crisis that is threatening the peace of the region and the peace of the world. We must begin, he argued, by sending aid into Gaza and then move immediately to a ceasefire and finally discuss the setting up of a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. Sisi insisted he would not allow Palestinians from Gaza to be pushed into Egypt's Sinai Peninsula to liquidate, as he put it, the 75-year-old Palestinian cause. This is not going to happen, and certainly not at the expense of Egypt. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas reiterated his PLO movement's long-standing position that violence is the result of the lack of what he termed a just solution based on an Israeli and a Palestinian state living side by side. He said Palestinians are not going to leave their land and they won't go away. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Meanwhile, Arab leaders at a Cairo peace summit condemned Israeli bombardment of Gaza as Europeans and said civilians should be shielded. But the absence of Israel and senior U.S. officials at the meeting undermined any prospect for halting an escalating war. The United States, Israel's closest ally and a vital player in all past peace efforts in the region, only sent the chargé d'affaires of its Cairo embassy, and Israel was entirely absent. As participants disagreed on an acceptable language, there was no joint summit declaration. Said Sadek, professor of political sociology at Egypt Japan University, analyzed the Cairo summit to viewers Mohammed El Shenawi.
This is the only regional and high-level summit over the Gaza crisis since it happened. We only had conferences at the UN Security Council, and it always ended in failure. This summit faced many challenges from the beginning. It was called earlier by Egypt and included inviting President Biden. But before that took place, we found that the U.S. chose not to come to Cairo and hold the mini summit in Amman, Jordan, with the Palestinian Authority president and the King of Jordan and Egypt. But the bombing of this Presbyterian Palestinian hospital made it very difficult, and this summit in Amman was canceled. And President Biden left Israel back to the U.S. and did not choose to attend, and even only sent a chargé d'affaires at the U.S. embassy to attend the summit. America has the greatest influence on Israel and really the one that can win the Israeli war, but they choose not to attend. Some Arab states also boycotted the summit because they thought that Israel would attend and so refused to send any delegation, but at any rate, they are marginal in this conflict to have any impact. There was no final communique at the end because the European and the Arab sides quarreled, should we condemn Hamas or not? Should we support the self-defense right for Israel, but not for the Palestinians? That also split the summit. And so there was no final communique at the end. And instead of this absent final communique by the summit, you had the Egyptian presidency issuing a statement explaining and assessing its aims that they wanted to build an international consensus to stop this war that left casualties on both sides and emphasized that it won't allow the liquidation of the Palestinian cause on its territory and will defend its own sovereignty over Sinai. There was no agreement on an immediate ceasefire, nor securing a permanent supply of aid to the besieged Palestinians from Rafah crossing point. Arab attendance aimed at balancing with the biased European stand. In fact, speeches of the Arab leaders supported the Egyptian, Jordanian, and Palestinian stand rejecting any transfer of Gaza into Sinai to as a final solution to the Palestinian problems.
In a press release issued by the presidency of the Arab Republic of Egypt on the Cairo Peace Summit, the spokesperson said Egypt looked forward to the participants launching a global call for peace. This shall lead in a short period of time to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state along the June 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. President Biden also stressed the commitment to the two-state solution. With the Israeli rage over the loss of civilians, do you envision any path for negotiating an independent Palestinian state?
This is a social protracted conflict, meaning it is complex, deep-rooted, it lasts a long time, it goes through cycles of violence and silence, but never ends in a knockout or final showdown battle. Only when the Israelis realize that this cycle of vengeance and counter-strikes will not bring them any permanent peace, and their peace would be more beneficial than imposing fake peace by force, there will be no change. Destroying Hamas will not end the conflict. Later, you will get Hamas 2 and Hamas 3. The two-state solution was really envisioned from the beginning of this conflict in 1947 when they called for the division of Palestine between the Jews and the Palestinians. And it was reaffirmed again in the Oslo Agreement that was signed in 1993. But once it was signed, both sides began to reject and refuse to apply it. We had the Israelis killing their own prime minister, Yitzhak Rabin, in 1995 because they didn't accept or approve this two-state solution. So the ball is on both sides. They have to agree that there is no military solution to this problem, and on the only feasible and rightful solution is a two-state solution. But so far, I don't see anybody is doing anything without the EU and the US imposing it and using diplomatic, economic, political pressure on the two sides. There is no way you will have new cycles of violence in the future after this one ends.
Saeed Sadek is professor of political sociology at Egypt's Japan University. He spoke with viewers Mohammed El Shinawi.
On this weekend's Issues in the News, we'll examine the devastating toll the war in Israel is taking on civilians and medical personnel, and regional leaders as well as the West hope to keep the violence from spreading using a number of tactics, including diplomacy. Listen this weekend on VOA's Issues in the News.
In Malawi, human rights defenders are welcoming a high court decision to drop treason charges against former Vice President Kassim Chilumba. Dismissing the charges, the judge said the state has not shown the willingness to proceed with the case after 17 years. The former vice president was arrested and charged with treason in May 2006 after he was accused of plotting to kill then-president Bingu wa Mutharika. The former vice president appealed to the High Court to dismiss the case against him since he says it has taken too long. Judge Ruth Chinangwa agreed with the former vice president and dismissed the case. For analysis and reaction, I read George Peary. He is a former lecturer at the University of Livingstonia in Malawi.
The reaction locally is that the judiciary is failing to hear constructively the cases which are politically motivated in Malawi, because dropping all the charges against the former vice president, Dr. Kassim Chirumpa, follows the case that the former president, Dr. Bakiri Muluzi, was also accused of some corruption cases, which the government finally dropped all the charges against the former president, which means that because the cases have taken too long to be heard, this is why it seems difficult to put together the evidences, because some of the people who were involved in cases like this have relocated and some have even died.
George, some people are saying that the former vice president was not treated fairly since he was arrested and charged in May 2006, and that 17 years is long enough for somebody to live under such conditions.
That is very true. And we needed, after that case, we needed to go back to the laws governing the office of the vice president and also even for the president, because it's seemingly in Malawi, we have had the same cases up to now. The office of the vice president, since 1994, when we adopted Matpate system, the office of the vice president has not been fairly functioning and fairly treated in this country. And this is why we have had cases of not only the former vice president, Dr. Kassim Chirumpa. We had similar cases also with the late vice president, late Justin Malawi. He was also not treated fairly the way he was handling the office himself, which means to me that the governing laws of this office needed to be reviewed.
Judge, there are suggestions that perhaps it's the individuals involved when it comes to the issue of the vice president and the president, rather than what the framers of the Constitution have it in the document. What is your thinking?
My thinking is that it still borders on the laws of the country, which needed to be reviewed to look at how this office is affected by some decisions from top. You know, all these cases are said to be political in nature. So if it is political in nature, then definitely for us to deal with the cases constructively and also looking at how individual persons who are working in the office of the vice president may be implicated in these issues, I feel that we needed to look at the governing laws. How possible is that only the vice presidents are affected since 1994, and to date is almost the 30 years period. We have had the cases concerning the vice president, and the presidents are not concerned about the cases, and they are also not prosecuted. So why is it that only the vice president? So in my view, I feel that there is a relationship between the laws of the vice president and the cases the vice president have been answering since 1994.
George Peary is a former lecturer at the University of Livingstonia in Malawi. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. South Africa will this week host the 7th Global Alcohol Policy Conference in Cape Town. The two-day summit aims to focus on the need for proactive steps on both local and international levels to address the dangers of alcohol abuse. Organizers say more than 400 delegates, including experts, activists, and scientists, are expected to attend the conference, the first to be held in Africa. Topics to be discussed include gender-based violence and alcohol, and new initiatives in promoting impactful policies and reducing industry influence. For more about the conference and its anticipated impact on South Africa and the rest of the world, I reach Sizwa Magango. She is the Chief Director for Social Crime and Substance Abuse at the Department of Social Development.
We have a problem of, underage drinking in the country, and we're hoping that through the interaction with the global community, we will be able to come up with interventions and policies that cap the underage drinking. We also have a problem of binge drinking, availability of alcohol. There's too much availability of alcohol. That's why young people, they are tempted, they are abusing alcohol simply because it's just too available. There's also a problem of advertising of alcohol during prime time, especially on television. And then lastly, also, I've acknowledged that alcohol is one of the drivers of gender-based violence.
Do you think that based on recommendations or possible outcomes of this conference, South Africa will be able to, or your organization will lead the effort in tackling these challenges that you have just enumerated?
Yeah, there's quite a lot that we are expecting, you know, out of this conference, which will really begin to shape certain processes and measures that we've put in place as a department and as a country. For instance, out of this conference, we are going to review, we're hoping to strengthen our institutional mechanisms that will assist us to coordinate better and standardize processes. We also want to promote standardized interventions in the country because, you know, without standardizing certain things, it becomes difficult to manage this problem. And we also believe this is the conference will also give us an opportunity to take stock on what is working and what is it that is not working. Because one of the things that we've been learning from the international community is that our interventions and policies must be evidence-based. If they are not backed by evidence, then they are not working. So those are the things that we're looking forward to get out of this conference and then begin to look at how we're doing business as a country and how we put those things in place.
You talked about availability of alcohol that the youth or young people are abusing. You talked about advertising on prime time. You know some of these problems. Why hasn't the organizations such as yours been able to resolve this?
The challenge that we are having is the fact that the alcohol issue, the fact that it cuts across so many issues, we need to agree in terms of how we should manage it. And sometimes we don't see the things the same way. We see things differently, and that's why it causes unnecessary delays and challenges. So we are hoping that once we, you know, we get the resolutions out of the conference, then we're going to call a meeting where all these departments are sitting and we share with them and say, can we come up with a plan that addresses specifically alcohol? Because we do have, of course, a multi-sectoral plan, which we call it a National Drug Master Plan. However, the plan, the focus is more on drugs. Not necessarily, you know, focusing too much on alcohol. And yet, for us, we've now acknowledged that alcohol is also is part of drugs as well, and it is a legal drug.
So what should be the expectations of parents and the South African society in anticipation of this global conference?
It's important maybe to also mention that this conference is a policy conference more than any other thing. The people that will first, you know, yield the results or benefits will be the policymakers, because it's more about ensuring that you've got a policy framework that is responsive to challenges of alcohol. And once we get the policy right, then the policy will influence the legislation. Some of these things will be legislated, and then once they're legislated and they are enforceable, then the community will begin, you know, to see the benefits of that, because there will be restrictions around the issues of alcohol, and more people will be protected from the abuse of alcohol. So those are some of the things to say. Even if maybe they may not be tangible results for them now, but what is key is that a conversation was that we will raise awareness, and we're hoping that the resolution of the conference will begin to shape the policy and the legislations of various countries, including our country.
Cesar Magango is the Chief Director for Social Crime and Substance Abuse at the Department of Social Development. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. A Ugandan lawmaker is calling on Parliament to investigate the alleged physical assault of colleague parliamentarian Francis Zaake. Ibrahim Semuju says the demand for justice must be addressed by the lawmaking body and asks for state security to provide protection to lawmakers. His call came after Zaake accused General Katumba Wamala, the current Minister of Works and Transport, for assaulting him during a 2017 heated parliamentary debate to remove age limits from the constitution. Local media reports Zaki throwing chairs at parliamentarians from the governing party, which led to the confrontation with General Wamala. For more about his call for the inquiry and protection of parliamentarians, I reach Ibrahim Semuju.
The Honorable Francis Zaki was boxed and cautious by the current Minister of Works, the Honorable General Katumba Wamala, who is the former army commander, during the consideration of the constitutional amendment bill that removed the age limit to allow Mr. Museveni to stay in power. He was again brutalized by soldiers who were guarding the president during a by-election in a rural district called Arua. So last week, NRM MPs came to parliament complaining that the Honorable Zaki had abused one of them when he visited their constituency. And my view to parliament was, this young man needs to be helped. He was boxed and cautious. Instead of subjecting him to numerous investigations, which is further abuse, he needs help himself because he was brutalized right inside the plenary.
Well, but what do you say to those who are saying your call is comparing apples to oranges and that the wrongs are not comparable?
You see, the MPs from the ruling party who were protesting for forcing the speaker to adjourn parliament, I asked them whether physical assault, whether beating an MP is a lesser offense than just an MP uttering words that are inappropriate. For you, you complain that one of your colleagues has been abused. For us, the complaint is that this guy, because that day, 2017, I was the first to be arrested and dumped in a police car. The Honorable Zaki was brought when he was unconscious. We had to make a lot of noise for the police to pick him, take him to Rubaga Hospital. So if you did not investigate a person who beat him right inside parliament, who are you now to investigate someone or who claims to have been abused miles away from parliament? Is that justice?
But do you think your call for parliament to also investigate is actually feasible?
I am only asking parliament to set standards. You can't have an MP walking into parliament during a sitting of parliament complaining that a colleague has abused me, and immediately you are instituting investigation. Yet you, the same parliament, you have an MP who was beaten nearly to death, and you do not carry out investigation. You see, the good thing MPs from the ruling party have taught us is that when they make a decision and it goes against you, can actually protest forcing parliament to adjourn. This is what we'll do. If they don't investigate General Katumba Wamala, who beat up Zaki, I am going to be demanding tomorrow. We will also make sure that parliament doesn't continue.
Are you not going to bring chaos in this case to parliament if you decide to take up this action?
I am only running from MPs from the ruling party because on Thursday last week, because of too much noise, shouting and jumping up and down, they forced the deputy speaker, Honorable Thomas Taibwa, to adjourn parliament. I am just being a good student that when a decision doesn't go your way, you can actually force parliament to adjourn.
Wouldn't governance be hampered by this? Because some people were saying the very essence of you being there to represent your people will be defeated by such actions as to disturb the parliamentary business in Uganda.
If we are going to adjourn parliament maybe for a day or two, it means that the administrators, the speaker and deputy speaker, and other administrators at parliament will now have to sit and set standards. If an MP visits a colleague's constituents and abuses that person, is that matter brave, strong enough that parliament must abandon its order paper and then begin discussing a complaint of abuse? I am only asking parliament that please set standards. If an MP has been abused, let them go to court. If an MP has been beaten in parliament, that's a matter for which investigation must be carried out.
Ibrahim Semuju is a Ugandan parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Senegal, the founder of a think tank called the Africa Jump Center is calling on detained presidential aspirant Ousmane Sonko to stop his resumed hunger strike. Aliontin B is also calling on the authorities to ensure there are no obstacles created to impede prospective voters from having the free will to choose who their next leader should be in next year's general election. His remarks come after Sonko, who leads the opposition party Pastel Le Patriot, announced he was resuming his hunger strike. This, despite a recent court ruling that paves the way for him to compete as a presidential candidate in the 2024 polls. For more about his calls on the opposition leader and the Senegalese authorities, I reach Aliontin B.
I have said in a post yesterday to Ousmane Sonko to stop the hunger strike. And I say also to all the women that are detained in the prison to stop hunger strike. And I say to the president, Macky Sall, that time is up to have peaceful situation in Senegal and to release all the political detainees. It was the meaning of my post, because we need free, fair, and peaceful election in Senegal. We have a very, very difficult electoral process with violence, with tension. And now we need a very peaceful political context to go have a very good election, free and fair.
People are suggesting that embarking on the hunger strike is the best way to put pressure on the authorities to let him go, because they said it appears that that is the only way that the government or the authorities responds positively.
You know, they have done it. Ousmane Sonko have done 30 days of hunger strike. 30 days. Do you think it? He was, many people was afraid for his life. And you know, it was the caliph general of the Murids, who said to Ousmane Sonko to stop. And he gave him something to eat. And this is why Ousmane Sonko have stopped the hunger strike. I, you know, if you make hunger strike, I think it is mean to put pressure. But I think that it is important to have also political leaders that can hear, understand, and have enough humanity to have the good response of hunger strike.
Government says it will appeal against the court's ruling that enables Ousmane Sonko to contest next year's election. So basically, his troubles are not going away, is there?
I think so. I'm afraid because it is not a sign of a future stability on this country. I think not that it was a very good thing that in Ziguinchor, the judge said, let Ousmane Sonko go and run. He have the ability and the right to go and run for the presidential election. This morning, when the delegates of Ousmane Sonko went to the direction of the election, general direction of the election, they said to him, they are not receiving people this day. I think it's very serious when they are not accepting the justice decision, the judge decision. We are in a country that we are supposed to have rule of law. I think that the administration of the election have to respect the rule of law, to respect the decision of the judge. It is very important.
Aliontin B is the founder of a think tank called the Africa Jump Center. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sport with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first,
And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We begin in France, where South Africa's Springboks snatched a late victory against England at the Rugby World Cup on Saturday. Defending champion South Africa was second best to England's smart tactics and precise execution for the best part of 70 minutes of their semi-finals at the Stade de France on Saturday before what's becoming a traditional great escape by the Bucks saw them steal a 3-16-15 win and set up a title decider next weekend against their fiercest rival, New Zealand. South Africa captain Siya Kolisi said he was really proud of his team but was quick to pay tribute to England, who almost defied the critics and rugby form in the repeat of the 2019 final.
England did so well in the kicking game. I think they outplayed us in that. Our discipline was awful in the first half, and especially in the key areas of the game, you know, where they could take the points. But yeah, I thought we fought back, you know, in the second half. We showed who we are and what we can do with the full 23. But yeah, we just want to thank all the South African people that travelled all the way to come here and support us.
The defending champions owe their victory to Andre Pollard, who converted a short-range try before ordering a 77th-minute penalty to give his side their second successive one-point win. Last week, they beat France 29-28 in the quarterfinals. Pollard, who replaced Maine Libok after 30 minutes, described the win as unbelievable while admitting frustration at the Bok performance.
It's unbelievable. It's a lot of relief in this moment, and now it's just, I was frustrated. We wanted our best tonight, especially that first half. We knew we had so much more to give, and we just couldn't get there. But fair play to England. I think they put us under pressure in exactly the right area, so credit to them.
And now to the wrap of English Premier League games played on Saturday. Manchester City beat Brighton 2-1 to return to the Premier League summit on a day when the action on the pitch was overshadowed by the death of England World Cup winner Bobby Charlton. Arsenal missed the chance to end the day in top spot but recovered from 2-0 down against Chelsea to draw 2-2 and are behind City only on goal difference. Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp praised Egyptian forward Mohamed Salah after he netted twice in their 2-0 Merseyside derby victory over 10-man Everton on Saturday, saying the team's talisman has the ability to score even on less than perfect days.
I think Mo Salah played for us an incredible amount of fantastic games today. It was not his best game, but being then that clinical and the penalty and that being staying in the situation, that's probably his biggest quality, and I love that because you need somebody who brings the ball over the line.
Newcastle, whose early season struggles are now a distant memory, romped to a 4-0 win against a sorry Crystal Palace side. Brentford beat Burnley 3-0, while Wolves came from behind to beat Bournemouth 2-1 thanks to a late winner from Sasa Kaladajuk. And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Juna.
Good evening, Africa. Any dispassionate, impartial, and keen observer would have discerned in the last 2 weeks a disquieting contrast between two worlds. In Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank, misery reigns. We have the image of hopes of a people whose lives are brutish, short, and disastrous. And yet, the international community has failed the people of the Middle East. As someone who happened to have spent 25 years of his international responsibility at the United Nations to deal seriously with the Middle East, and knowing full well many of the personalities involved, the terrain and the twists and turns, I can confidently say the international community has failed these people. It is not because of lack of trying, yes, but because of the difficulties of the situation, many preferred to go for short measures, step by step diplomacy, Camp David and Oslo. All of these avoiding to tackle the most difficult issue facing the international community. And the United Nations and the Security Council have really, really failed the people of the world. Instead of pursuing what should be the solution, geopolitical consideration, to win or not to win, has prevented the halting of the raging war now going on in the Middle East. Who would have thought that there would be a Security Council that would calibrate the timing of war moves? Who would have thought that responsible powers would wait to see what would be the outcome of particular military moves? We know all the possible just solutions, yet those responsible are refraining from taking action. Fortunately for the people of the Middle East, there is at the moment no possibility giving this generation of peacemakers for a solution. In contrast to this hopelessness and misery in the Middle East, on the other side of the world, also last week, heads of states from Africa, from Latin America, or in Europe and Asia met in Beijing to celebrate the 10th anniversary of an initiative by President Xi Jinping called the Belt and Road Initiative, a project which was looking for reconciliation, drawing on the ancient Silk Route to see whether in our present day this initiative we connect with people, Asia, with Africa, with Latin America. And they all agreed in the forum, at the summit last week, that this program has been very, very successful. It has brought people together. It has improved the lives of people in many countries. And yet there are those who, for geopolitical reasons, try to find faults about this initiative, which was prepared and continues to survive for a community of shared future. The sad thing for Africa is there is a concerted attempt to convince Africans that they should turn away from this bright future. And the tool they have used is to tell Africans that there is an insidious aim to join this initiative, because it provides not only infrastructural development and human development, but also look ahead for the greening of the universe. And they tell them, don't get involved. There is at your doorstep neocolonialism, and you are involved in a debt trap. And there are many Africans, regrettably, who are buying into this nonsense. The concept of debt trap did not originate from Africa. It was first brought into being with Sri Lanka in Asia, but they have been able to turn their back on the nonsense. So I say to Africa, particularly African academics, that you have an obligation to do your own research. It is not difficult, though it may be time-consuming. The facts are all there. Don't rely on op-ed pages, even from prestige papers. Don't take seriously even articles from prestigious economic journals. Do it yourself, and you will find out that much of the argument of debt trap doesn't make any sense. In the 1990s, there was a project called HIPIC, heavily indebted countries, most of them in the African countries. The Bretton Woods Institution and major donors tackled that East China was not even nearby. And the same conditions which produced HIPIC in the 90s is still with us. If you look at the statistics about debt trap in your research, you'll find that debt owed to China is no more than 20% of the debt of many African countries. Most of them are from Western financial institutes or business or even the IMF. So all I can say to you is the consequences of missing out at the project which has enriched Asia will be sad for us. No possibility exists for major intellectual developments in Africa than what you have here. And Africans should not allow such things to go on without fighting back. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Yes, I'm good. Yes, good. Yes. I'm so happy to have you here today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and I've been listening to your music. And you know what? It just reminds me of Like, it just makes
me... And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent.
Some other music that you have, you got that, you know, that love vibe.
Word.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like Valentine's Day all over again. Or, you know, if you don't have someone close, then by the time you hear it, you're going to need to get something close, okay?
Word.
But yes, let's talk about you, Kali. So tell me, how did you get, like, how did you know you had a skill? That's the first thing I want to know. Like, was you just singing in the bathroom? It's like, yo, you know. Yeah. I sound good.
You know, thanks for having me again. I go by the name Kali Abdu from birth. And, you know, I came into a music family, if you will. My dad, he was involved in music in the church, you know, and all of that. And, you know, when I was growing up, I used to see him writing songs, actually, you know. I would hear him humming melodies, and I would see him running to find a piece of paper to write the chords down and things like that. And I used to notice and say, that's interesting. And I had an affinity for sounds and music, and I always used to record sounds in my brain, and I'll find my way to the church and help the band set up. And then when I helped them set up, I, you know, mess around with the instruments. So I taught myself how to play the drums that way. And I started messing with the keys. I go to the church when it's empty and just start messing with the piano or the organ.
So this was in your blood.
Yeah. And so that's when I saw what my dad was doing, I knew this is where it was coming from for me. And over time, you know, I learned songwriting actually from my mom. And
your mom?
Yeah.
Really? Mommy had it too?
Yeah, she wasn't like a singer. She was just, she was a very organized person. And, you know, my uncle was getting married, and they wanted us to sing, all the kids to sing. And so I saw her. She was the first person I saw writing an actual song.
Oh, you're
serious? She wrote the lyrics. So I said, oh, that's interesting. So I picked that up.
Whoa.
Picked up arrangement and organizing sounds from my dad. And that, you know, I put those together, and that was the beginning for me.
That is fabulous. Like, I wish I could write. I mean, we was talking earlier, and I was telling you about, I wish I was a poet. Like, I just want to be like, but writing is not my talent. Producing is.
All right. Yay. So, you know, I used to DJ. I'd go to the club and I would play music, and girls would really be dancing. They'd come up like, this song, I love this song. And they'd really get into it. Now, the moment when they actually get into it because they really love the song, that's what inspired it.
Right.
And so I wanted to make a song that would make you dance. And
this one is definitely going to make us dance, and we're going to take a listen to it right here. So we have Winded by Kali Abdu.
Said you were done. Go and run, pull now. Pull now. You said you were done. Come down this way, come down. I got
I'm feeling his tune. He got me dancing in the studio.
That's love. That's love.
Old lady.
Appreciate that.
Got an old lady dancing in the studio.
Yeah.
So tell me.
Yeah.
About this, like, you told me that this was from the Book of Solomon.
Now, yeah.
I read the Book of Solomon.
All right.
And I know those songs was actually read for the Queen of Sheba.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
Bet you thought I ain't know that, did you?
I mean, I'm not surprised.
You know,
you are deep, so
I'm not surprised.
Yes. But yeah, so that was inspired by, that is so nice, though.
Yeah.
I've never heard that. That was,
yeah.
That's very good. So, my question is to you, like, you know, I know that you perform,
because
I've seen your videos.
And okay.
You guys, all the listeners out there, have you seen this guy perform? He's naturally very reserved.
Yeah.
I don't know, what is it about me and interviewing people that are naturally reserved? It is just like musicians are just naturally cool, calm, and collective.
Yeah.
But once they get behind the mic, it's a different,
it's different
thing.
Yeah.
Yes, let's get into Romantic Girl.
Oh yeah, and she came with a new tight game, seeking the fame that we did not gain. But boy, she knows how to shake that thing, how to reach that thing. Gotta play that string. I play that music when the night falls. Play the record that we rock and we'll be right for. All the girls in the late night flow, you made that fall, you shake that fall.
Doesn't she know that she's what I feel? No, girl, don't do no that. You don't know that.
Put it on me, on me, on me, on me. Put it on me, on me, on me, on me. I want a romantic girl, pretty little thing to love me like me. A romantic girl, pretty thing to love me like a child. I need a romantic girl, pretty little thing to love me like me. A romantic girl, pretty thing to love me like a child. She like the sound of that. I hate the sound of us apart. We like the sound of this. So we've been partners from the start. We've been mine ever since. I like to lose her in the dark. I think I found a kiss. I think she thinks I'm fine. I think she loves my style. I'm going to make her mine. All mine, all mine. Girl, don't you think I'm fine? Girl, don't you love my style? I'm going to make you mine. All mine.
Yes, we are back in the studio with Kali Abdul.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yo, you know what? You got some serious vocals.
Thank you so much.
Brother, I'm serious. It's like the R&B of Africa.
Thank you, thank you.
It is.
Yeah.
You got a talent and a skill, and yo, you got to get back on your grind.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on.
Right.
And so what advice would you give someone trying to get out there in the mainstream?
Don't worry about contracts. Don't take any contract from no one. The reason I say that, it seems a little extreme, but here's what I mean. I think people need to get into self-development first. Don't be in a hurry, because I see a lot of young people, they come up to me, especially with my charity work that I'm doing, and the first thing they say is, I want to be famous, I want to be popular, and I say, that's the wrong approach. You want to do some self-development first, focus on building yourself, because you come out, you don't really know who you are yet. You need to.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer